Episode 98, Oregon, The Struggle for Possession by William Burroughs, Chapter 2.
Welcome to the Principles in Practice podcast. This is where we discuss biblical principles for life and learning. I'm your host, Heather Hall, and this is my co-host,
Brian Hall.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Principles in Practice Biblical Classical Homeschooling podcast. We are moving forward with the account of Oregon's providential history as documented by William Burroughs in his book, Oregon, A Struggle for Possession. If you missed Chapter 1, go check out Episode 95. Episodes on Oregon's providential history are debuting on Fridays. Real quick, in the description for the podcast, you can find a link to donate, which will help us keep our podcast going, and we sure appreciate all of your support and prayers for us. Additionally, you can find the link for donating at principledacademy.com. And now for Chapter 2, Spain Enters the Struggle and Fails. The claims of Spain in North America have been marked off. A notice of the vast shrinkage in her pretensions prior to the Treaty of Ryswick will prepare one to trace, in this chapter, her weakening and final departure from the contest for Oregon. To prevent collision between Christian princes, on the 4th of May 1493, Alexander VI published a bull in which he drew an imaginary line from the North Pole to the South, 100 leagues west of the Azores, assigning to the Spanish all that lies west of that boundary, while all to the east of it was confirmed to Portugal. Since Spanish navigators had explored somewhat the Atlantic Ocean and coast as far as Newfoundland, Spain claimed, by this papal authority and under the name of Florida, the whole seacoast as far as Newfoundland and even the remotest north. Since Spanish navigators had explored somewhat the Atlantic Ocean and coasts as far as Newfoundland, Spain claimed, by this papal authority and under the name of Florida, the whole seacoast as far as Newfoundland and even to the remotest north. In Spanish geography, Canada was a part of Florida. Yet within that whole extent, not a Spanish fort was erected, nor a harbor was occupied, nor one settlement was planned. And when St. Augustine, Florida, was founded, the bigoted Philip II was proclaimed monarch of all North America. More surprising it is to see such pretensions set forth at a much later day. The Archbishop Lorenzana, in his History of New Spain, published in 1770 at the City of Mexico, says, "It is doubtful whether the country of New Spain does not border on Tartary and Greenland, by the way of California on the former, and by New Mexico on the latter." The bishop was poor in geography, and was in the error then still lingering, that America was made up of big islands extending west and ending in the East India Islands, and that one could sail through somewhere from Newfoundland to China. When the French began their discoveries and settlements in Canada and the other northern provinces, the Spanish gradually, but under bloody protests, withdrew their claims toward the south. After the Jamestown colony was established and parts of New England occupied, they consented to make the southern boundary of Virginia the northern boundary of their Florida. This was about 1650. And when the Royal Province of Virginia had about 15,000 white inhabitants and 300 Negro slaves. Then followed the English grant for the Carolina plantations and the Edict of Nantes that expelled so many Protestants from France, furnished many colonists with other adventure. The Spanish remonstrated against the encroachments, but the English would not acknowledge a claim both unwarranted and unused. At length, about 1690, the Spanish quietly contracted the limits of their shrinking Florida and agreed to the line already named, being a little north of Charleston and running exactly west from Cape Romaine to the Mississippi River. Having set bounds, mutual and somewhat permanent, on the seaboard between themselves and the English, the Spanish already began to feel encroachments of the French down the Mississippi from the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes. Vague and fascinating rumors had gone up from time to time among the scattered and frozen settlements of the St. Lawrence about great rivers that never froze over and plains and warm valleys toward the South Sea and the Gulf of Mexico. As early as 1658, French fur traders had wintered on Lake Superior, and 2 years later, the devout Menard had gone up there to a death that he knew must soon come from the Indians, that he might plant the cross on the barbarous border. More and more, trader and Jesuit, forgetful of all toil and danger, threaded the Indian trails to the headwaters of rivers that disappeared in the mysterious Southwest. The almost social waters, as if talking of better homes and more sunny climes to which they were hastening, tempted these Indian merchants and preachers to the bold venture. So, with only blankets and food for a few days, they pushed their frail canoes into the jolly waters, saying, "Where shall we land? In the Sea of Virginia? In the South Sea? In the Gulf of Mexico? In China? In Cathay?" In 1607, the spirited La Salle, a Jesuit priest in France, a fur trader and feudal colonist in Canada, and an ardent dreamer of the Straits of Anian opening somewhere from the Atlantic to the Pacific, floated in his birch canoe south as far as Louisville. In 1671, St. Lusson, with his 15 white and swarming red men of 14 tribes, chanted the Wexilla Regi at the Sault Ste. Marie, the outlet of Lake Superior, and took possession for Louis XIV of all the country bounded by the seas of the north and of the west and of the south. It was a wonderful occasion in that deep interior wilderness in North America on that leafy morning in June, and on an eminence at the foot of the rapids, the civilians in showy armor and the Jesuits in their robes surrounded the wooden cross and chanted and offered prayers. The Indians, crouching and gliding and gazing on all sides, watched the pompous ceremonials while a large part of North America was made over to Louis the Grand. A volley of musketry, a vive le roi, and the yelping of the savages closed the marvelous scene. Mr. Parkman, in his Discovery of the Great West, a captivating volume where true and pure history makes the highest romance, tells the story with fascination. 2 years later, we find Marquette and Joliet at the mouth of the Arkansas, and in 1682, La Salle appears again, and now at the mouth of the Mississippi. With what daring and romance, grand expectations these early voyagers and the first of white men must have glided into and through those primeval solitudes. 2,500 miles they pushed off into the unknown among savages and wild beasts. Now they take the broad stream midway, and now under its dark forest banks. One timid deer is shot from the grazing herd, and no sound like that has ever waked echoes in that stillness of ages. The calm evenings come over the prairies, and then the cheery campfire, venison, vespers, and sweet sleep. Shortly after the Treaty of Ryswick, the French began to occupy, and with energy, that portion of the Great Valley that was recognized as their own. As early as 1705, Kaskaskia had become a populous and happy French post, and 7 years later, it was constituted the capital of the Illinois country, having a population of 2,000, a monastery, and a college. It was a marked frontier town and had the vicissitudes of Indian, French, and English wars. In 1778, Colonel Clark, by one of those heroic and romantic movements that have so signalized our frontier and stored it with material for American Walter Scott, took possession of it for the young republic. In 1682, La Salle spread French claims over the lower Mississippi, and 3 years after he annexed Texas to the realm of his king and established a trading post and fort on Isle Dauphin, between which and Quebec a lively trade sprang up. Thus, early the active and progressive French opened a way into the very interior and indolent New Spain, and were transporting not only peltries and furs, but grain and flour and other agricultural products down that mysterious river. The same persistent discoverers, the trader and the Jesuit, also opened the Ohio, Illinois, Wabash, and Kaskaskia. The bold and far-reaching plan was adopted to connect the Great Lakes with the Gulf of Mexico by a cordon of military posts. About 1720, the first of them, Fort Chartres, was founded on the eastern bank of the Mississippi and about 45 miles below St. Louis. It became the French headquarters for Upper Louisiana and continued for a long time their western center of life and fashion, intrigue, and ambition, the Paris of the Great West. So active were the French that in 1730 they had planted 140 families and 600 converted Indians on the Illinois alone, and 5 years later they founded Vincennes on the Wabash as a military and rallying center. Such was the colonizing activity of the French in the upper Mississippi, thus overshadowing and making timid the Spanish below. But in lower Louisiana, the encroachments were still more annoying and alarming. In 1699, D'Iberville made a settlement near Ship Island and proposed French control over the whole coast and region from Pensacola to the Rio Grande. He surveyed the Mississippi for about 400 miles to the region of Natchez and caused an exploration of Red River for 1,000 miles from its mouth and the Arkansas up to the Little Rock, while the Washita and Yazoo were not neglected. The Missouri he explored up to the entrance of the Kansas and the Mississippi to the St. Peters, waters now made familiar by steamboats and crossed by railroads, the light canoes and pirogues of D'Iberville glided over like waterfowl shooting rapids, making carries and submitting to no obstacles. No white man had ever before much disturbed these hidden recesses of nature. In 1710, the entire population of Lower Louisiana amounted to only 380 souls, a small village today. The men were ignorant, indolent, and vicious. Negro slaves and Indian girls did most of the work, and the loose arm's-length government was supported by 175 soldiers. The Spanish governor at Pensacola remonstrated against these French intrusions, but as his remonstrance was able to do more, it was in vain. On the east of the Mississippi, the Perdido had been accepted by both governments as the eastern line of the French and the western one of Florida. But on the west of the Mississippi, all claims to territory were in a contested uncertainty. While the Spanish claimed eastward across Texas, almost to the Mississippi, the French claimed westward across the entire province to the Rio Grande. Nor was the struggle between the two foreign crowns confined in that Indian wilderness of the New World to the Gulf Coast and the delta of the Lower Valley. Spanish adventurers from New Mexico and the Santa Fe country had ranged north and east across the upper Arkansas to the Missouri and Mississippi, and found there also the intruding irrepressible French. An expedition was forwarded to expel these traitors and colonists, but the result was very disastrous to the Spanish. After this, the French built Fort Orleans on an island in the Missouri, above the mouth of the Osage. In military connection, and about the same time, Fort Chartres was built, as before mentioned. The wonderful changes in the bed and channels of the Mississippi are seen in the fact that Fort Chartres, originally on the bank of the river, was washed away and then rebuilt, and of stone, far inland. The encroaching river followed and is undermining the new fort. For 10 years, ending about 1750, the French were active in establishing friendly relations with the Indians between the Alleghenies and the Missouri and from the heads of the Mississippi to Texas. This was a deep stroke of policy and involved vast labor. By all these explorations and encroachments, the French crowded the Spanish to the south and west of the following line. From the mouth of the Sabina up that river to latitude 32, then due north to the Red River, and by it to the longitude 23. Thence, north to the Arkansas, and up it to latitude 42, and on it west to the Pacific. This was the boundary, practically, that the French forced on the Spanish, though it was not then very formally or definitely agreed to. Indeed, it was one of those singular treaty lines sometimes appearing in history on which much has been settled, while they have never been run. The one in question has had a peculiar history. When, in 1762, France secretly conveyed her western portion of Louisiana to Spain, she made this its limit on the southwest. But it was only descriptive, having never been run or traversed by either party. When Spain reconveyed the same to France in 1800, it was limited by the same boundaries and in description only. In 1803, France sold this territory, the Louisianas, to the United States, with all its rights and appurtenances, as fully and in the same manner as they had been acquired by the French Republic. To this extent, and on a line unrun and not very definite, the United States were now bounded on Spanish territory. And for 16 years there was negotiation, and at times unpleasant struggle, to locate and run the line. Then, when in 1819 the United States purchased Florida, an article was inserted in the treaty restating this line, but it was drawn only by diplomats in sentences and not by engineers on the ground. The treaty called for a survey, but various delays prevented the setting of meets and bounds till we acquired New Mexico in 1818, when the line became unnecessary because we became owners on both sides of it, and so it has never been run. It is a singular fact that this line of three August conferences and treaties, one war and much diplomatic intrigue and correspondence, was never anything more than imaginary and declared. We have thus grouped the facts, that it may be seen in summary how France crowded Spain on the southwest and compelled a continuance of the shrinkage in her boastful claims of the New World. Now, it is important to notice that the old Spanish claim extended from Panama on the Pacific to Prince William's Sound, and of course covered the Oregon of our narrative, that is, the Oregon, Washington Territory, Idaho, and British Columbia of today, up to 54 degrees 40, according to the decree of Pope Alexander VI. The Spanish had granted to them exclusive privileges in all lands and seas which they might discover in the Pacific. On this basis, they founded the audacious claims of sovereignty over the American shores of the Pacific. When, therefore, the English, profiting by Cook's discoveries that ended with his death in 1778, and by the enterprise of others, sought to open the fur, seal, whale, and other traffic on the northwest coast, the Spanish government regarded the attempt as an intrusion, and in its anxiety as to the end sought by its rival, entered strong objections. This arrogant claim of Spain to all Pacific waters and coasts and islands near to our continent is well illustrated in the case of the American ship Columbia. In 1788, she left Boston for the trade in the Pacific, was damaged and put into Juan Fernandez for repairs, and having been refitted, was allowed by the Spanish authorities there to proceed. For this commandment was removed under severe rebuke, on the ground that every vessel found in seas beyond Cape Horn without Spanish license was to be treated as an enemy, since no nation had a right to territory or trade that would require the doubling of that cape. Russia was already on the northwest coast of America, and Spain sought to make Prince William's Sound the southern limit of Russia. This was in 1789. At this time, no settlement, factory, or other establishment whatsoever had been founded or attempted, nor had any jurisdiction been exercised by the authorities or subjects of a civilized nation in any part of America bordering on the Pacific, between San Francisco and Prince William's Sound. It is true that Spain led off in discoveries on those coasts, and afterward she had jointly with England, France, and Russia landed here and there and taken possession ceremonially. But it early came to an understanding among these nations that no such pageant could constitute possession. That could be proved and maintained only by habitations and residence. The issue between Spain and England as to sovereignty on the northwest coast was made at Nootka Sound in 1789. Each nation then attempted to form a settlement there. The Spanish captured the English vessels, and this threw the case into diplomacy between the two courts. England informed the Spanish court that she could not accede to the pretensions of absolute sovereignty, commerce, and navigation that were claimed, and secretly prepared to back her protest by two fleets. The Spanish government was informed that British subjects have an indisputable right to the enjoyment of a free and uninterrupted navigation, commerce, and fishing, and to the possession of such establishments as they should form, with the consent of the natives of the country not previously occupied by any of the European nations. The younger Pitt, then in his prime of power, and with all his father's hatred and contempt of Spain, shaped the policy that ended in the famous Nootka Treaty of 1790. The question opened so widely that France did not think it best to remain quiet, and though she seemed to maintain neutrality, she took steps at once to increase her navy to unusual proportions. Under Louis XVI, Mirabeau led this policy and by a semblance assumed to mediate between the two courts. The result was the Nootka Treaty, by which England gained her full commercial demands. 5 years later, Spain, for various reasons, informally and quietly and without quite claiming her rights, withdrew from Nootka Sound and afterward fixed the northern limit of her claims at the present northern boundary of California. When she withdrew thus to the southern limits of Oregon, she could well be counted out as a competitor for the Oregon of our story, though she had owned it from 1763 to 1800. Here, therefore, we take leave of Spain in the grand game of kings for that magnificent prize in the Northwest. But we cannot do it without reflecting on the weak ambition and papal folly that grasped for so much while it could hold so little. Spain once claimed from Panama on the Atlantic side to Newfoundland and on the Pacific to Prince William's Sound. At this date in our narrative, all her Atlantic claims were dwarfed to eastern Florida, and at this date of writing, all her vast interior and Pacific claims have gone out of her hands. As we look back on this amazing collapse of the Spanish inflation in North America, the view should not surprise us. With a few noble colonial leaders, the mass of the colonists were of the lower grades, and many of them from prisons, asylums, and the streets. Any country would be benefited by the outgoing of such classes, or damaged by their incoming. After landing in the wilds of America, they were more like dumb-driven cattle than like citizens. The Jesuitism that took charge of their education by no means crowded on them with printing press and spelling book, and priestly hands held back the Bible, though in Latin, and religion was much embodied in rituals and ceremonials. There was nothing in such a colonial system to produce men and women who constitute and perpetuate society. And with that, I will leave you with some of your thoughts, and I hope you join me for Chapter 3.
As always, if you're looking for additional resources or support, you can visit our website at principalacademy.com, check out our shop and our blog, and you can also find us on Facebook at Christian Homeschooling with Bible Principles, also on Instagram under Principal Academy. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Well, this is Heather Hall.
And this is Brian Holm.
For Christ and His glory.